Hi, this is Rick Emerson, and the following encore of Legion of News is brought to you by Squires Electric. Whether it's electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, or wiring of any kind at all in your home or business, Squires Electric can make your life easier. Find out more at squireselectric.com or call 503-252-1609. Squires Electric.
Greetings, fellow Portlanders. From the Emerson News Network, this is Legion of News!
Atop the milkpacking district in the heart of beautiful southeast Portland, Oregon. This, my friends, is Legion of News, a one-hour distillation of all important knowledge from everywhere. My name is Rick Emerson alongside Don Taylor, who is, even now as I speak these words to you, preparing information on a vast swath of happenings, including, but not limited to, the following.
A woman drowns in the Willamette after falling off a raft. A man dies on the freeway after falling out of a convertible. And everyone's looking for Muammar Gaddafi.
As always, my friends, have no doubt that this conglomeration of factual discourse and ideological screed will render you shocked, amazed, enraptured, and demonstrably more intelligent than when you began this hour. And now, without further ado, cover your innards, for this is Legion of News.
Good afternoon. I'm Dawn Taylor, and this is absolutely everything you need to know for Monday, August 22nd, 2011. A Vancouver man who investigators say kept on driving after a passenger fell out of his convertible and died over the weekend is now facing hit-and-run charges. Washington State Troopers said the convertible was traveling westbound on SR-14 near milepost 19 east of Washougal when 34-year-old Jose Gonzalez Ramirez was sitting in the back of the convertible. The driver, 29-year-old Russell Amon, tried to pass another car, and that's when Gonzalez Ramirez fell off. Witnesses immediately stopped, but state troopers say Amon did not. State troopers released a description of Amon's champagne-colored Mercedes-Benz convertible to the media and eventually tracked him down. Amon was booked into Clark County Jail on one count of felony hit and run. Sheriff's deputies say alcohol was a factor in the incident, and detectives are still investigating.
So, but they already caught him, so they're not looking for him. They already nabbed him, he's already in the joint?
It doesn't... I think they need to rename hit and run, then, if you're going to charge someone for it after someone falls out of their car.
Well, and also, it denies
really
me the
upper... It's really leaving the semen of an accident. Well, it's not hit and run.
It also denies me the opportunity to say, police are looking for Amon, who they believe is involved in a...
Yeah.
And then I giggle.
You could say police found Amon.
No, it's not the same. No. This doesn't work. Don't taunt me. You're listening to Legion of News. It is Monday, August 22nd, 2011. This is Cascadia.fm. Thank you for joining us on this Monday. If you want to get this program later on the day via iTunes, you can do that. It's also available as a direct MP3 download here at Cascadia.fm or at legionofnews.com. You can take it with you on your mobile device as well. That is mobile.cascadia.fm. Mobile.cascadia.fm. Here is Don Taylor.
A teenager who police say tried to take an officer's gun during a struggle was arrested and taken into custody on Saturday. Officers with the gang enforcement team were conducting a traffic stop at the intersection of Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. and Lombard when one of the passengers became combative. A struggle ensued, and Anthony Ray Tolliver, 17, of North Portland, grabbed onto one of the officer's guns, which was in the holster. Robert King of the Portland Police Bureau said Tolliver continued to violently pull on the gun handle, causing the belt to come loose and rotate on the officer's body. The gun remained in the holster, though, as officers were able to get Tolliver onto the ground where he was handcuffed and placed into leg restraints.
Seriously, you don't want to do that. You come between a cop and his gun, it's like coming between Kirstie Alley and a crawler. I mean, it's just you're gonna fall down 500 or 600 times on the way to the police station, and then they're gonna fix you up, and they're gonna take you to another police station. You're gonna fall out there too.
And then they're going to charge you with every single thing they can think of because he has been booked into a juvenile detention home on charges of attempted unlawful possession of a firearm, attempted theft, interfering with police, resisting arrest, disorderly conduct, assault on a police officer, and criminal mischief.
Fantastic. By the way, somebody points out that this is, what is the name of the organization or the branch of the law enforcement community that he was a...
The gang enforcement team.
The gang enforcement team. So it is, in fact, a team facing off against a gang.
Or it's a team that is enforcing the gangs. They're actually helping the gangs, is what it sounds like.
Too bad we don't have a team going against a gang, going against a gaggle, going against a...
I don't know.
Collective?
Collective? A
conglomeration?
Murder?
A murder?
A murder of gang members?
A pride of something or other? All right.
Don't forget
the Rick Emerson radio program coming up next hour at rickemersonshow.com. Today we have a Taser Watch, Darwin Watch coming up, and Mr. Aaron Duran with the Week in Geek. Here is Don Taylor sitting at the news desk.
On Friday, Burger King announced that it was parting ways with Crispin Porter and Bogusky, the edgy ad agency that created the current incarnation of the Burger King mascot. By the way, Crispin Porter plus Bogusky, it's like White and Kennedy, where they have a plus instead of an and.
I was thinking it was like Lisa and Cult Jam with full force.
When do we start doing that, by the way? Start using a plus sign instead of an ampersand, but still saying and instead of plus.
I don't know. I was also thinking it was like, wait. Did I already say Lisa?
You did. Tony?
No.
No.
It's, there's somebody else. There's another one of those groups that's, it's just like lingering right outside the vestiges of my, or a word like that, the edges, the periphery of my consciousness. It's, no, I've got nothing.
USA Today reports the end of the Burger King's reign is a done deal and will likely be made official sometime soon. Possibly later Friday. The move is the first of many steps Burger King will likely take over the next year to recast itself in a more health-conscious image.
Well, they're the ones who came up with the subservient chicken and then everything that followed, all the way through the creepy Burger King, who apparently was beheaded in their new commercial. So it's all, which I haven't seen, but that's the word. That was the word from my dig peeps, was that the Burger King was, hello, kid, you know, and then head off.
Well, the new campaign, ad campaign, is going to start this weekend, and Burger King's going to unveil their California Whopper, which will be the latest fast food fare to include guacamole. USA Today reports, in a serious image twist, the entire commercial shows only the sights and sounds of the fresh ingredients being washed, sliced, and diced. No words, just pulsating music. And no creepy Burger King, apparently.
No, but it's creepy enough that they're apparently doing some sort of vegetable porn in the new commercial. Also, when you think about things from California, you don't really think health. I know that that's not how Californians... I know that's not their goal. I know that Californians like to believe that they project an image of themselves as being health conscious and body aware and frolicking in the sun and constantly looking as though they're the picture of vitality, but they don't. Californians always just, they always look simultaneously overfed and underfed and gristly and filled with plastic.
It depends on what part of California you're in, really, because there are vast swaths of California that are...
The horrible part of California that is projected to the media and that is depicted as being representative of that part of the United States always just looks very, very thin and very, very lardy at the same time. It's sort of a good omens kind of a thing. You're listening to Legion of News here at Cascadia.fm. I am printing some news for you over here on this side of the studio. You'll have that here in the moment.
Hooray.
In the meantime, Don Taylor will entertain your senses, all of them, except perhaps those that don't involve sound, with this story.
A man claims he was assaulted after trying to sell marijuana to former Portland Trailblazer Zach Randolph at his home in West Lynn on Sunday. James Beasley, 26, said he went to Randolph's home to sell marijuana, and when he was there, there was a disagreement over price, so several men beat him with pool sticks. After Beasley told the same story to detectives from Clackamas County Sheriff's Office and to KGW News, the sheriff's office decided they would go to Randolph's home around 12:30 Sunday morning. Randolph, who was not considered a suspect in the case, was home while the search took place. Beasley said he suffered a concussion in the attack. His brother Robert said they were upset with Randolph for not stopping it. Robert said, I'm very, very disappointed. Zach was there and he should have stopped it. He could have stopped it. I mean, he's a large man, I suppose. This will be the second violent incident involving one of Randolph's friends this year. On New Year's Day, a nightclub bouncer was shot to death in downtown Portland. Kevin Moffitt was a known member of Randolph's entourage, and he was later arrested and charged with the crime. The Clackamas County Sheriff's Office seeking tips and information regarding the crime. So if you know anything about a guy going to Zach Randolph's house to sell some pot and getting beaten with pool sticks, they want you to call the police.
This is a whole day where everything just seems just beyond my grasp. So first, I try to do the follow-up on the Lisa cult jam in full force joke, for which I don't believe I was given the proper amount of credit. And I know that there's really nobody else here in the studio with us, and so I wouldn't really know if other people were giving me credit or not, but I'm sensing just my read on the cultural ripplings today, on the zeitgeist, is that there wasn't... Here's what I wanted when I did that a few minutes ago. I wanted everyone to stop whatever they were doing and turn, look at the speaker, and nod and smile and say, "That Rick Emerson," and then just get back to working. And I don't feel that
was
actually done.
You don't know that they didn't. They might have done that.
No, it's like I have a finely tuned internal barometer for these things, and I know that that didn't happen. I know that there was one guy named Theodore who did that in Northeast Portland, and that's it.
And a guy in his car somewhere who put his hands up and went, whoop, whoop.
Also, later tonight, there's going to be a guy who cleans like a Woolworths, using one of those like high-powered like electro-buff things for the floor. And he's going to stop, and he's going to go, and he's going to continue, and that'll be it. That's only going to be it. And then just now, I feel like there was a, see, if I could have gone a Mrs. Beasley route with this story.
Yeah.
But no, there was no, but Mr. Beasley, what am I supposed to do with that?
Yeah, Mr. French was unavailable for comment.
But you can't do that when it's Mr. Beasley.
No, not really.
All right, well, in any event. Here's goddamn Don Taylor at the news desk.
Irene has strengthened over Puerto Rico. I'm assuming they mean the hurricane and not Irene Cara, the star of fame.
Well,
Irene has strengthened over Puerto Rico to become the first hurricane of the 2011 Atlantic season. The National Hurricane Center's Robbie Berg says residents in parts of the southeastern U.S. could be in the hurricane's path in 3 to 5 days.
Areas along the coast from the Keys to Florida up to the Carolinas need to keep watching the situation. Start thinking about what kinds of preparations you would make should you be put under a hurricane watcher warning later this week.
The hurricanes, that's another one of those things that those guys at Intellectual Properties or Intellectual Ventures or whatever that company is in Seattle where they make the where they make the three-dimensional food printer. And the laser that zaps mosquitoes out of the air. That's another thing where it's like they claim to have solved it. It's just that nobody will listen to them. There's this guy at Intellectual Ventures at Myhrvold's company who's all, "Yeah, I figured out this whole way to stop tropical storms from brewing." Basically, and it's like a thing that looks like it looks like an inner tube, like you float in on the river. It's an inner tube that just has like a plastic funnel in the middle of it. And he's got like 70 of them. And he goes, "Yeah, if you just take these and you put these at equally spaced intervals on the surface of the ocean in areas where you get hurricanes, they won't happen anymore." Yeah, there's no chemicals or anything. They're just inner tubes. You just float them there and it's...
And yet no one has decided to take him up on it.
Everybody just goes, "Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, all right, thanks."
Well, you would know, it hurt
try?
Apparently, worst thing that happened, that there is a hurricane and we have some inner tubes out there.
Don't even get me started on this thing they did to... on this thing they came up with to stop global warming. It would just infuriate you. If you just, in fact, I would recommend that you never read about it because it would just, it'll just make you irate.
Well, Robert Berg says Irene has strengthened as it moves over Puerto Rico.
Even though it's been over land,
feeding on the souls of its enemies
with this system, and it is now a hurricane with winds of 75 miles per hour.
As Irene feeds on the fear and, I don't know, it seems like Irene just doesn't conjure up a lot of, I'm trying to...
No, it doesn't sound terrifying
I'm
in
trying
any
to,
way.
Yeah, to bring this sort of, to bring
Irene it, Ryan. Imagine a giant Irene Ryan just looming over Puerto Rico.
See, that's the thing, is there's really nobody menacing named Irene. There's nobody. Irene is just like, Irene is just sort of like your aunt who's not really crazy, not really all that interesting, not really mean, not really nice. She's just kind of there.
My mom's best friend was named Irene.
Married to a guy named Hank. Yeah, see, and it's like, what are you supposed to do? Irene is a completely neutral name. It is the... It is the warm glass of water of the name world.
It seems like Irene is the name of the nice old lady down the street who gives you cookies.
I'm going to put Irene into Wikipedia and see if it gives me any suggestions for people that are... What did you come up with? Irene Cara?
Irene Cara and Irene Ryan.
All right.
Who was, as you know, Granny on the Beverly Hillbillies.
Yeah, I've got... first result. Irene the Concierge, character portrayed by Sharon Jordan on the TV series The Sweet Life of Zach and Cody. Okay, that does not... The fact, that, by the way, that it comes up in conjunction with the names Zach and Cody does not really lend to the... lend anything, any menace to it.
I have never watched The Sweet Life of Zach and Cody, but since they are young boys who live in a hotel, I know that much about it, and she's the concierge, maybe she is their nemesis, and therefore she could be a little scary.
There is a Irene Van Dyke, New Zealand netball player.
Oh.
All right, there you go. Okay.
Is that it?
Anyway. Here's Don Taylor at the news desk.
President Obama and other world leaders are calling on Muammar Gaddafi to surrender now that rebels have secured roughly 95% of Tripoli. Gaddafi needs to acknowledge the reality that he no longer controls Libya, President Obama said in a statement issued late yesterday.
He clearly does control Libya if we can't make him leave. If we're still asking him to do something, he obviously
still controls. Well, he has free will over himself.
But I'm saying we don't control Libya, clearly. Mm. Who, I mean, if not him, then who? If he's not controlling Libya, then who is it? And if it's not him, it clearly is somebody who wants him to still be there. But it seems like it probably is him if we're still having to ask him nicely to do stuff.
Well, who are these Libyan rebels who have been clashing with the loyalists?
I don't really know.
Are they in charge yet?
Doesn't it seem like this same story was happening like 6 months ago? Haven't Libyan rebels been clashing with people, like, for the better part of this year?
Well,
I mean, when Anna Griffin was still coming and doing the second show with us, they were feeding this the same line.
That kind of is the nature of rebels, though, isn't it? They're clashing with somebody.
I guess. It just seems like...
They'd just be Libyan, you know, calm people.
How hard could they really be rebelling? I mean, really. Yeah. It's, especially because every time they show a picture of Muammar Gaddafi, it looks like he's kind of enfeebled and sort of foggy about what day of the week it is. And so it doesn't seem like, at this point, especially if they've controlled 90% of the country, unless he's just got the 10% that happens to have all the guns.
By the way, they keep referring to him as the Libyan strongman.
Is he a wrestler?
Unfortunately, I'm a woman, so I can't be called it, but I keep thinking that would be, like, awesome if people would refer to me as the something or the strongman. Because that has a really nice ring to it.
Well, why do you don't have to have a penis for that. You just take it back. Make it a gender-neutral term.
What kind of a strongman would I be? What would the modifier be?
Well, you're not in Libya.
No. I probably couldn't be the Portland strongman because I don't actually, you know. I'll have to think about it.
No, people are immediately rebelling at the at any. You can't be strong pony. That you have to be show pony.
Strong pony. That's something to aspire to, isn't it? Though
strong
pony.
I don't know. It makes me feel weird.
That's after I start working out and I get all muscly, like what's her name in the Terminator sequel.
Okay.
Anyway, Britain, France, Germany, and other European countries joined the call on Monday, while also urging the rebels to respect human rights and not exact revenge on Gaddafi loyalists. According to the Washington Post, Gaddafi's exact whereabouts are still unknown. If the Libyan strongman is able to escape the country without being captured, his most likely destination will be Angola or Zimbabwe, according to Al Jazeera.
Okay. I think we've got some sound on this, actually, in the sound sheets that I gave you. I think we've got somebody speaking about Libya there.
Yes, this is Shadi Hamid. Director of Research at the Brookings Doha Center. He says beyond a few thousand residents, it's unclear how loyal the residents of Tripoli really are to Muammar Gaddafi.
We don't really have a sense that these are people who are really willing to die for Gaddafi, especially when I think it's clear to everyone now that, you know, time is running out for Gaddafi and the people around him.
This is one of those things that would carry a lot more weight if Ronald Reagan hadn't been saying the same thing back in, like, you know, 1982 or whatever.
Hamid is Director of Research at the Brookings Doha Center. He also says it's pretty clear there are very few residents of Tripoli who remain. So now he's saying, first he said it's unclear how loyal the residents were. Now he's saying it's pretty clear there are hardly any residents of Tripoli.
Keep in mind that this NATO operation has been going on for 6 months. Gaddafi's resources and equipment has really been undermined by this constant barrage. So take all that into account, and we can really understand why Gaddafi has ended up so weak here.
I feel like this is one of those things that's just rushing into the news vacuum. Like, when there's nothing else that's occupying the front page, there's no real huge story. Like, Hurricane Irene, clearly not going to be a contender for an A story. So Muammar Gaddafi is just sort of flooding in to fill the void. That we wouldn't really care about this or be talking about it in any way if there was anything, like if a picture that vaguely resembled Jesus had appeared anywhere, any time this weekend, we would be talking about that. But now, you know, it's just Gaddafi. Like,
well, I wonder if this is going to be another thing, though, where we have this image of him, like, hiding out in these dank safe houses by his loyal compatriots. And then if they do find him, he's just going to be in, like, some really nice suburban home, like, playing on a PlayStation.
I think that would be great if we found Muammar Gaddafi, like, in Indianapolis. You know, just hanging out. Like, not even working, but, yeah, just, like, living in some guy's basement, you know? It's like, well, you've got the mom, and you've got the dad, and you've got Skylar and Casey, and then Muammar Gaddafi.
Momar, it's taco night.
I mean, the Train Matter, I was talking about wanting to do some other sitcom, you know, to follow up in the heels of That's My Bush. How about, you know, why not, you know, Momar Comes to Indianapolis or something. So,
3 Men and a Momar.
Yes.
Yeah. One of two women wearing blue bodysuits and rubber masks told police on Wednesday that she and her friend were only joking when they ordered a package store clerk to open the cash drawer.
What is a package store? Is this in a Mickey Spillane novel?
That's like a liquor store, is a package store.
They call it a liquor store then. Seems like a package store sounds like, it has packages as opposed to a liquor store, which, you know.
This may have been in England.
Okay.
It's in Manchester. So, Arlena Clark, 23, and Megan Callahan, 21, entered M&J Wines and Liquors on West Middle Turnpike on Wednesday about 5:30 p.m.
That does sound foreign.
A man who had seen them go in thought their all blue clothing and character masks from the movie Saw were very suspicious and called the police. The liquor store clerk told police that one of the women said, "This is a stick-up," and ordered him to open the cash drawer. The clerk yelled at the two and told them to remove their masks or leave, police said. They took off the masks, and the clerk identified Clark, who was a customer he knew, and she told him it was just a joke. Clark, who is homeless, told police they were wearing the blue costumes, quote, to mess around because they were bored.
I wish that there was... and this is one of those things that I can't... that I'm not really able to do. I can't do the John Kramer voice, or I could... You know, I can only do the... I have come here... No, see, and I can't... I can't do the Jigsaw voice. Because then it would be a whole thing of, like, they're torn between... They're torn between, like, Tanqueray and...
Bombay,
you know, and then, you know,
make your choice.
And then it doesn't really work. I can't do the thing.
Yeah, you shouldn't wear the Saw mask, actually, if you can't do the voice.
No, and what is the Saw mask they're talking about? Is that the mask of, like, the little thing on the tricycle?
Well, I don't know. I think the Jigsaw...
Because he himself doesn't really wear a mask.
Sure he does. He has
a cloak. He has a hood.
So I guess they're talking about the thing with the eyes.
Yeah,
that's
a little wooden. It's a little wooden marionette.
Okay.
Yeah, rides a. Was it you that has seen all seven Saw? I mean, I know it's me too.
No.
Who was it you know that has seen all seven Saw films?
I think that's Eric Snyder.
Because he wrote a thing about it or whatever.
Yeah.
All right.
I have not actually seen any of the Saw films all the way through.
Really? Oh, they're terrible.
Yeah.
No, they're terrible. They're all awful.
I kept trying to watch one because I had read an overview of some of the plots, and I went, oh, well, it actually has a continuing story.
Yes.
That might be interesting.
Well.
And then I tried to watch one, and I just, oh, no.
Well, it is interesting. No. Let's not confuse that with good, though. I mean, it's not, there's no quality of any actual kind to be had there. Interest, yes. Quality, not so much.
No.
Here's Don Taylor.
Let's dive into a little science news.
All right, here's your Science on the March for Monday, August 22nd, 2011. This is brought to you by Squires Electric, ladies and gentlemen. You can find them at squireselectric.com or facebook.com/squireselectric, or you can call them on the telephone if you like. That is 503-252-1609, 503-252-1609. They are licensed, bonded, and insured electrical installers, contractors, and supervisors. That means they can deal with the wires or wiring in your home or business for whatever might be plaguing you. And by you, I mean your wires. And by your wires, I mean your electrical system. And by plaguing, I mean not working or needing to be installed. So they can take care of that so that you don't have to needlessly endanger yourself and your loved ones. And also your sense of dignity as a man. It's 503-252-1609. It could be sort of a sour grapes kind of a thing. Like, I could have fixed this problem myself, but it's way beneath my pay grade. It's far too easy for me. I'm gonna have Squires come do it. It's not worth my time. It's 503-252-1609 or squireselectric.com. If it has to do with wires or wiring in your home or business, they can make your life easier. Now, you're the proud sponsors of this, your Science on the March.
NASA's humanoid robot has finally awakened in space. Ground controllers turned Robonaut on Monday for the first time aboard the International Space Station. The robot was delivered to the orbiting complex back in February. It took this long for the operating software to get up there and for the astronauts to have enough time to help with the experiment.
Did it wake up in space like Mr. T waking up on an airplane, just not knowing? Damn it, fool, how'd you get me on this?
Exactly, yes. They should have programmed it to do that, actually.
Yeah.
The test involved sending power to all of Robonaut's systems. The robot was not commanded to move. That will happen next week. That must be very frustrating for Robonaut.
Robonaut! It's a little Black Sabbath for you.
Team members were exhilarated by today's successful test. It's being tested as a possible astronaut's helper. And nothing could possibly go wrong.
Someone is angry here saying, why in the name of God is this the first time that we're hearing that we have a robo-knot? Come on.
Oh, we've talked about the robo-knot before.
I don't recall that.
Oh, we did. They've got a humanoid robot that's up in space.
When did we talk about this before?
A couple of months ago when they first announced it.
This was in the real world?
Yes. No, we talked about it on this show.
Okay.
Robonaut's also known as R2. He is the first humanoid robot in space. And for now, he only is actually a humanoid robot from the waist up.
So they had,
I guess, so he can't chase them.
Well, that's like me, too. And Larry King.
Yeah.
Below the counter, it's just dust and sticks and Jim Henson. So what is it? Why did they have to wake the robot up? I mean, why wasn't it? It's a robot. Why was it asleep?
Well, they had, I guess the operating software hadn't arrived, whether it had to go on a different... Because it's the International Space Station, so I guess they had to send it on a ferry, or it took that long to beam it.
It hadn't gone gold.
I have no idea, but they didn't have the operating software yet, so they had to wait.
The studio was busy making Duke Nukem Forever. They weren't quite able to finish the OS in time as well. They had to make a decision.
They had to send a guy to stand in line at the Apple Store.
Seriously.
And to pick up a disc.
Look, I'm sorry, it's not done. You're just gonna have to download it from the App Store when it's done, sir. There's no disc ready. I'm sorry.
Violent protests in North Africa and the Middle East in 2008 and 2011 coincided with large spikes in global food prices, according to a new study. The analysis, which spans January 1992 to May 2011, suggests that high global food prices are a precipitating condition for social unrests. This, according to Yanir Bar-Yam and colleagues at the New England Complex Systems Institute in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Their study also calculates a food price threshold above which vulnerable populations typically find themselves in desperate straits. This indicator could help guide policy interventions.
So what you're saying is when people don't have any food and they're starving, they tend to get pissy.
When food is really, really expensive, they start getting all angrified.
Okay.
Patients in persistent vegetative states often get tagged as having less mental capacity than the dead. Ending up in biological limbo is also regarded as a fate worse than death, says psychologist Kirk Gray of the University of Maryland.
How can somebody have less mental capacity than the dead?
I don't know. That's what I'm just saying.
This isn't real science.
Religious and non-religious participants alike attributed in this study attributed less mental activity to vegetative patients than to the dead due to afterlife beliefs and a tendency to assume that deceased but unseen people still have minds.
Oh, I see. It's not that they have. It's that they are believed, they are perceived to have.
Right.
In other words, people are just making things up.
Right.
Okay.
This is was in the journal Cognition. Religious people will also usually advocated life support for vegetative patients, despite regarding such states as being worse than death.
Well, now I'm confused again. So...
religious people will...
But if you have more mental capacity when you're dead and less when you're vegetative, it seems like then you would skip vegetation, go right to death.
You'd think.
Unplug him right now, this instant.
Religious people don't believe in... it's that whole sanctity of life thing, even though they believe that particular life is actually worse than being dead.
Somebody lacks the power of their convictions.
Skip that one. Microfossils found in Australia show that more than 3.4 billion years ago, bacteria thrived on an Earth that had no oxygen, a finding that boosts hopes that life exists on Mars. Researchers from the University of Western Australia and Oxford University say the remains of microbes located in ancient sedimentary rocks that have triggered debate for nearly a decade have been confirmed as the earliest fossils ever recorded. Sample came from the remote Pilbara region of Western Australia, a site called Strelly Pool, where the microbes, after dying, had been finally preserved between quartz sand grains. Pilbara has some of the Earth's oldest rock formations, set down in the so-called Archean Eon, when the infant Earth was a primeval water world. In 2002, another team of scientists working in the same region said they had found bacteria fossils in the same formation, but that claim was disputed, with some experts saying that the tiny pockmarks were not the signatures of once-living organisms, but the result of mineralization of the rocks. So using the latest electron microscopy and spectroscopy...
Science!
Using them fancy things where they can see really tiny stuff, they say they have triple proof that their sample is biological in origin, and the microbes they believe fed on sulfur compounds to survive. And if that is the case, they say there could be things living on Mars.
Did they say triple proof?
Triple proof.
Okay, it's been hella proofed. It's been full-on proved.
It's bona fide.
All right. So this is another one of those. This is like the planetary equivalent of the Muammar Gaddafi thing, though, where at which and then that in turn, they are both versions of the dairy story about eggs. The thing, like, I have this whole I forget what I termed it, but I had this whole system where I was comparing things to eggs and the way that eggs were depicted in the media, because I had it worked out at one point to where it was like every 7.5 months the thing changed about whether or not eggs were good for me, because I could never really keep track of it. It was like one day I would pick up the newspaper and eggs will kill you dead, and the next day it was eggs are fantastic, have some now, and I was never really able to suss out whether the media was telling me eggs were good or bad. I mean, leaving aside sort of issues of contamination. So it is with Muammar Gaddafi. So it is with Mars. I can't keep track of whether or not there's goddamn evidence of life, like, ever in the past or now on Mars or not. In fact, after hearing you read this story, I still don't know.
I don't think there's any evidence of it yet. They look at things like this. They're basically looking at... there's a lot of researchers who...
Didn't you just say they found fossils? Didn't the story just say they found fossils?
Yes, in Australia.
Okay, but are they from Mars?
No. They are fossils from so long ago that they were microbes that fed on sulfur. They didn't need oxygen to survive. So therefore, the theory is, if life can't exist without oxygen, there might be life elsewhere that there is not oxygen.
They always go right to Mars with this, too.
Well, yeah.
You know, see, that's the thing, is they have to throw Mars into the story. I think it's because they know that people are expecting it. I think Mars is like the Clint Howard of these stories, where it's like he's got to make an appearance at some point, or the audience is going to go, but Clint Howard wasn't in this one. Yeah. You know, it's just like that.
There was a really terrific show on one of the public, on Discovery this weekend, actually. It's a series called Curiosity. And they take...
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
The one about aliens?
No, there was one about humping.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the one with Maggie Gyllenhaal?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, they also had one that was on that was about aliens. And they basically about if what would happen if aliens came to Earth. And they went to all of these biologists and astrophysicists and archaeologists and people and essentially just, you know, first of all, debunked everything that we possibly think... you know, about aliens, like, no, they're not going to attack us. No, they're not going to blow us up. If they come here, they're not going to come here for our resources, because there's all these other places they pass along the way that they could get plenty of water and minerals and that sort of thing. So, no, if they came here, it would be because they are also some kind of a carbon-based life form looking for someplace else to colonize. And they would not want to destroy the whole joint before they moved in.
Well, no, not before the raping happens.
No, and so then they also said, here's how, and it would be a global attack. And so then they said, here's what would probably happen. They would drop a whole bunch of EMPs on us and disrupt all of our electricity so that then we couldn't, like, drive our cars with our electric, you know, transmissions, so we couldn't use our phones or have, like, heat or electricity in anyone. Then they'd just move in.
Then we'd have only Snake Plissken to save us.
Yeah, and it was actually pretty interesting to hear these highfalutin science people talking about, like, no, that's not how it would happen. It would happen like this, which is far more scary.
Yeah, no, I figured that we're effed regardless. I mean, it doesn't really matter. It's there was that line in the there was the, that great exchange in a movie actually I saw for the first time in about 10 years. Last weekend, 2 weekends ago, I watched Contact again, which I love, which is one of my favorite films, and it's a film that I try not to watch all that often because I am such a huge fan. Because I was a massive fan of Carl Sagan and of the book Contact. But there's that great exchange that Tom Skerritt, who is always sinister in everything he does, even when he's not trying to be sinister, yeah. He is. But they were talking about, you know, Jodie Foster, of course, is a big freaking hippie. And she's talking about the idea that, you know, how ludicrous it is to assume that aliens would come here just to attack us. And she says, you know, like, why? Like, she said, that would be like us going out of our way to step on an anthill in Africa. And he has that retort where he says, how bad would we feel if we actually did that? And the answer is, not at all. So I just assume that whatever comes here is going to hose us, because that's, A, because that's what we would do. And B, it's because it's what we have done, and so it seems like we got it coming.
Well, my favorite thing that anybody said on that whole show was one of the science guys saying, listen, if you're a deer and you live in the forest, who do you have more to fear from? The guy with the gun or the developers who want to just tear down the entire forest and build condos?
Seriously.
So, speaking of which, PayPal founder Peter Thiel recently invested $1.25 million to create a floating city. By offering support to the Seasteading Institute, he has jump-started efforts to create city-state communities afloat on ocean platforms.
This is a great and terrifying story, by the way. Seamus and I have been emailing about this a little bit because he was the one who brought this to my attention with the subject line of, like, I am there! I am moving there as soon as it's possible! I'll be curious to see if this story has what I've found to be the best quote in the entire thing.
I don't
think
there's any quotes in this at all.
So I'll find it.
In 2009, the Institute held a 3D design competition to help people visualize what these seabound communities would look like. The structures will be 12,000 tons, diesel-powered, and carry about 270 people per unit. The idea is to link the structures together to create ocean metropolises equipped to accommodate millions of people. Thiel hopes to place the structures beyond the coastal jurisdiction of existing countries and their laws. Call it a libertarian pipe dream, but he hopes to experiment with different types of government styles. In some cases, he wishes to start up city-states without minimum wages and welfare, with fewer weapons restrictions and looser building codes, he says. Seasteading already has a team working on the legal issues involved. Floating pilots, which will include office buildings, will also be placed off the coast of San Francisco as early as next year.
So I've got the story right here, which I might link to this. This is from Liz Goodwin of The Lookout, and then it was posted on Yahoo News. Let's see. So, and this is, I guess, originally from an article in Details magazine. So he's, so there's that place that they have, I guess, which is off the coast of England called Sealand, which is an old, like an oil drilling derrick or platform or whatever, you know, like one of the big things on four legs that sits out there. And it's beyond, it's outside the 12-mile border, so it's in international waters, meaning that, it is a place without law. And so Thiel's whole thing is to build, and they have a great artist rendering of what it would look like. And it looks a little bit like that weird Gilligan's Island floating treehouse thing that Fisher-Price used to sell, like in the mid-80s, but then with like a huge with a huge boat next to it that kind of looks like the World, which was that passenger ship that docked here about a year and a half ago. It was like the world's largest passenger ship. Let's see. It says, Thiel's been a big backer of the Seasteading Institute, which seeks to build sovereign nations on oil rig-like platforms to occupy waters beyond the reach of law of the sea treaties. The idea is for those countries to start from scratch, free from laws, regulations, and moral codes of any existing place. The article says the experiment would be like a floating petri dish for implementing policies that libertarians, stymied by indifference at the voting booths, have been unable to advance. : No welfare, looser building codes, no minimum wage, and few restrictions on weapons. Thiel says, there are quite a lot of people who think it's not possible. That's a good thing. We don't need to really worry about those people very much, because since they don't think it's possible, they won't take us very seriously, and they won't try to stop us until it's too late. Which is awesome. So, there you go. So I think Seamus is already saving up for a house on this island, which... And I think my response was, whether it works or not, I think it's going to be entertaining regardless.
Oh, yeah.
That is, it's going to provide the rest of us a little bit of amusement for some time. Excellent. Fantastic.
That's all the science.
All right, there you go. There's your Science on the March, brought to you by Squires Electric. You can find them at squireselectric.com or 503-252-1609 or at facebook.com/Squires Electric. Coming up next hour, the Rick Emerson radio program at rickemersonshow.com. Today, your Taser Watch, Darwin Watch, and Mr. Aaron Duran with The Week in Geek. That is all on the way. You can listen for just the for the low, low cost of just 32 cents a day. Ladies and gentlemen, here is Don Taylor.
The a former Reagan aide on Friday became the latest member of the Republican establishment to blast Rick Perry for his comments about Ben Bernanke and the Fed.
Is that Rick Perry? Turn it up!
As you recall, Rick Perry said that it was positively treasonous, the things that Bernanke was doing with the Federal Reserve. Bruce Bartlett, who served as a domestic policy advisor to Reagan and was in George H.W. Bush's Treasury Department, said in an interview with CNN's American Morning, Rick Perry's an idiot, and I don't think anyone would disagree with that. Despite his work history, Bartlett is no stranger to Republican criticism. In 2006, he penned the book Imposter, How George W. Bush Bankrupted America and Betrayed the Reagan Legacy.
Oh, burn.
So, yes. To reiterate, Bruce Bartlett says, Rick Perry's an idiot, and I don't think anyone would disagree with that.
Yes, because that, of course, disqualifies you from becoming president. Americans would in no way ever vote twice for an idiot.
No.
Wouldn't ever happen.
A woman floating down the Willamette River with friends drowned on Sunday afternoon after her raft struck a log and capsized. The Lane County Sheriff's Office said deputies and firefighters found a man from the raft who made it to shore. The woman was pinned by debris underwater about 25 minutes and could not be revived when firefighters pulled her out. County Search and Rescue Coordinator John Miller told the registered guard that 25-year-old Paola Wilkinson of Cottage Grove had a life jacket with her in the raft, but was not wearing it at the time.
Oh, it's that last step that always gets you. It's the details, really, that are the undoing sometimes.
The Columbia Sheriff's Office says no one was injured when a family dispute erupted into gunfire at a trout farm near Vernonia.
That's too bad.
A 57-year-old woman, Sally Ann Lee, was arrested early Monday after deputies and officers surrounded a trailer. The sheriff's office said she fired at least 4 shots Sunday evening at a family member and sent others running for cover at Lee's You Catch Trout Farm. She was reportedly upset about her house going into foreclosure.
Catching some lead is what you're catching.
Lee now faces 4 counts of attempted murder.
Let's go back to this business of the woman having the life preserver in the raft as just sort of decoration. It was just there as like a cosmetic sort of a thing.
Well, you know, you can't really get a good even tan while you're wearing your life jacket.
And so this is, but it was just the two of them. It's going along. It hits what? It was an inflatable raft, I guess, is what you're saying.
It struck a log and it capsized, so it went upside down, and I guess she was pinned by debris under the water.
All right, yeah. I don't understand anybody who gets on the Willamette River, like, at all.
Well, at all, yeah.
In any event, under any circumstance, because it just seems like you are. Seems like you're asking for a lot of trouble, you know, infection-wise or, you know, drowning-wise. Also, it occurs to me that sending the firefighters, really, they really need water fighters is what they need there. Fire not really your biggest problem. All right. Here is Don Taylor at the news desk.
Rivals Ford and Toyota are announcing an agreement to collaborate on developing a new hybrid system for light trucks and SUVs. Sport folkswoman Nancy Geo explains how long the process might take.
I didn't catch that last name.
Joya. Something like that.
How's that name actually spelled?
G-I-O-I-A.
Joya?
Joya, sure.
Okay. I'm sorry, she says what about what?
She explains how long the process might take.
We're working now on the feasibility stage. That's just kicking off. We hope to have a definitive agreement early next year or next year, and then we'll be working on the next phase of that and expect to have vehicles on the road in the next decade.
So it's going to take them 10 years.
Yeah.
It seems, look, I don't know how to build a car, so, I mean, I couldn't build a car in 10 years. I couldn't build a car in 10,000 years, but there are people who can build cars, and so it seems like they should be able to design something and get it built in less than a decade.
Why weren't they already working on this before?
Also, don't you just assume, we've talked about this before, that, you know, the idea that American-made cars are, you know, are not always, you know, made in America and usually not made solely in America. And so it seems like this is a thing that they've already taken they've taken many, many, many steps into this forest already. Like, they're already partnered on some level, so, you know.
I'm surprised. I would be surprised if Toyota didn't already have hybrid light trucks and SUVs, like, say, in another country, in, say, Japan.
Well, because I think the rest of the world is much more lax. Here's the thing. I think we're kind of the only countries that really care about this. I mean, that's like the whole thing of the Prius, how they have to build the Prius in other countries. I didn't know this. Thomas Gill was telling me about this. They have to build the Prius outside of America because it's so toxic to the environment when you build it that we actually wouldn't. They won't allow it to be built in the United States because it's so bad for the environment. That actually the construction of the Prius itself is so toxic to the environment, it actually runs afoul of our own environmental regulations to build it. So, but, you know, buy it because it's good for the earth.
I think a lot of car companies have operated under that assumption for a long time. A lot of companies, period. Have you ever been to Mexico City?
Well, I was in a big brown cloud that they claimed was Mexico City.
Yeah, it's interesting that you land in Mexico City. The plane descends through this heavy brown fog, and then you get off the plane, and then you leave the airport, and everything smells like horror and death, and everything you see around the airport are industrial buildings for American companies.
Yeah. Well, and not surprisingly, that's where I know there were many people who, in the 90s at least, were buying cars that were sort of these bootleg cars made in Mexico City. Like, there was some Volkswagen for a while that they were making in Mexico City that I guess you could buy And I don't think you could have it shipped, but I think, like, if you were willing to go down to, like, a border state, you could buy it, and they would, like, a guy would bring it over, and you'd pay him for it. But they were making these Volkswagens that got, like, 75 miles to the gallon or something. But, of course, the reason that you had to go down to Texas to get it is because it was built, I don't know, it was, like, made out of children's tears and tortoise shells or something, and it was just horrible for the environment. But, you know.
Yeah. So this lady from Ford says, the talks with Toyota began even before tough new U.S. mileage standards were announced.
This is just consistent with our desire to lead in fuel economy, reduce CO2 emissions, and provide ongoing solutions for our customers that meet their needs in an affordable way.
Here's the thing is, she forgot that she had this press conference this morning, and so she just reached into her files and she pulled out my generic crap I say for all occasions folder and just grabbed a piece of paper out of that.
Because it's just a load of crap. You're doing it because you have to.
See, you actually were paying. You got much more out of that statement than I did. I don't even really know what she said. I just know that it sounded like the same thing she probably said for every speech.
Well, they're doing that thing where they're going, oh, no, we've been working on this. We're not making the hybrids because we're being forced to by the government or even because market forces are demanding it right now. We've been talking about it for a long time because we care. Mm-hmm. We care about people. No, you don't. You really don't.
Someone says, if we cared that much, we wouldn't be driving hybrid trucks and SUVs. We would be driving smaller cars.
Yeah.
See, that's the thing that, by the way, that's the thing that allows me to be smug, is that I drive one of the smallest cars that I was able to find. I drive a car that is effectively a roller skate. And so, you know, I might not be able, I can't be like, I can't be Chevy Volt smug, you know, but I can be reasonably smug. So, you know, as long as I can get through my day with a little bit of that, that's all I care about.
And then my friend Bobby, who has a couple of very nice vehicles, he has to, over the week of Labor Day, they're going to be resurfacing the parking lot in his apartment complex. And he asked if I would babysit his SUV for him. He calls it a truck. I think he's embarrassed. He would never refer to it as an SUV, but he refers to it as a truck.
Here's the difference. The difference between a truck and an SUV, I'll tell you right now. Is he afraid to scratch it? If you got a scratch or a ding in it, would it bother him?
Not a small one. I think he'd be okay.
Okay, then it might be a truck.
Yeah.
If you're afraid to dent it, it's an SUV.
Yeah.
If you're not afraid to dent, that's why.
I always think a truck has a bed. An SUV is enclosed.
Maybe. Well, it's like when we had that 4Runner. And we had this, like, beat-up 4Runner for the longest time, and people always said it was an SUV, and I would say it's not an SUV because I don't care if it gets covered in mud and scraped down the side. That is the dividing line between because a truck is functional. You know, an SUV, although people claim it's a sport utility vehicle that people don't use for sports or utility purposes. A sport vehicle, the only tools you're hauling around are your fat-ass kids. That's it. You're not actually using it for anything sport-related.
To be fair, almost the only thing that Bobby does use it for is to load up in the winter when he goes skiing.
Well, but
and
that's,
they can put skis in it, and then they can drive up the mountain.
Well, that's a legitimate outdoor, you know, function, though.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that
is a sport.
If you don't ever take it anywhere where it's going to get used for any sport or utility purpose, it is not really an SUV. It is, it's basically just a big station wagon then.
Yeah.
And people don't like to say they have a station wagon, which is why they came up with the term SUV in the first place.
Let's do our entertainment news.
Here's your entertainment news for Monday right here at Legion of News at Cascadia.fm.
David Letterman is back at The Late Show after a two-week vacation, his first day at work since a threat against his life was posted on a jihadist website. CBS has declined to comment on any special security measures being taken at Letterman's Midtown Manhattan Theater for a Monday taping. Last week, a frequent contributor to a jihadist website posted a threat to Letterman. He urged Muslim followers to cut the tongue of the late-night host because of a joke the comic had made about Al-Qaeda leaders on his CBS show. The website is a popular internet destination for radical Muslims. It is unknown whether Letterman planned to address the threat on the air.
I like the idea that there's
he's going to.
A frequent contributor to an Al-Qaeda newsletter. It'd be like one of those people that's constantly, like, snarking about whatever crap they just put up at the Huffington Post.
I wonder, do they have wacky names on there, like the guys on Ain't It Cool News?
It's like the Mr. Like, Baby Man of,
Yo, Butt Cheeks 666 says...
The hell?
What did you just do?
I didn't do anything. And I'm on a Macintosh, by the way, so that wasn't me.
And I'm not plugged in for sound, so that wasn't me.
Well, that's just weird.
Okay. Liam Gallagher is suing his older sibling and former Oasis bandmate over recent comments Noel made about the group's eventual demise in 2009.
That's hard to believe.
Liam, 38, said in a statement, "I have taken legal action against Noel Gallagher for statements he made claiming Oasis pulled out of the 2009 V Festival Chelmsford gig because I had a hangover."
By the way, that's not what Liam said. Liam just said something unintelligible and filled with profanity and whiskey, and then a mouthpiece put that together.
"That is a lie," he said, "and I want Oasis fans and Oasis fans and others who were at the show to know the truth."
Okay, don't hate.
I'm not.
Okay.
Liam insists he had laryngitis, which had been diagnosed by a doctor, and that Noel, 44, was very much aware of it. What's more, Liam is also upset over another comment Noel made during the same July 6th press conference where he made the hangover allegation. In the same statement, Liam said, "Noel also falsely stated that the demise of Oasis followed a massive row in which he claimed I had demanded to advertise my clothing range, Pretty Green, in the Oasis tour program. The truth is there was no such discussion or row between us. There are many reasons why Oasis split, but it had nothing to do with my clothing company." And Liam wants folks to know the lawsuit has nothing to do with money. Said, "I have tried to resolve this amicably, but have been left with no choice but legal action. All I want is an apology."
You know, we really have entered a different time. It seems like it was just yesterday that they were solving everything by punching each other in the face on stage.
I know, those were good times.
I mean, really, those were the best of times. I mean, who wants to see things resolved, you know, peacefully in court?
No.
With barristers and so forth. Please. Just, you know, each get a brandy bottle and, you know, and then, you know, 10 paces.
Yeah, just
done.
Drunken fisticuffs. That's what we want from Gallagher Brothers.
I really am disappointed that, the many times I've seen them, they've never actually just brawled it out on stage. Never. I mean, and it's like every time you go, that's what you hope for. You just hope that it degenerates into a riot of some kind, and it never has. It's very sad.
It's like going to NASCAR.
Right.
You don't really want a car to flip over and burst into flames, yet on some level you're kind of hoping it will.
There's this, I have this great DVD, this bootleg of the Oasis Unplugged show from many years ago. And that was notable because it was actually the first full-length Oasis performance where Liam wasn't present at all. He claimed that he had, wait for it, laryngitis.
Huh.
And he's all, "I've got laryngitis, I can't sing," or whatever. And Noel just said, like, "Well, sod it, I'll do it myself." And the entire... Noel went down and did the entire show himself, like 90 minutes or whatever of Oasis. And it was awesome, by the way. And it was great because it was a total demonstration of, like, you know, Liam's total uselessness and his appendix-like nature as a member of that band. The best part, though, was that every time there was somebody in master control, every time, because they would go to commercial break and Kurt Loder was sort of the MC, and Kurt Loder would say, "If you're just joining us, Noel Gallagher, filling in for brother Liam, who has a case of laryngitis." And every time he would say laryngitis, or every time Noel Gallagher would reference that Liam had laryngitis, they would cut to Liam Gallagher sitting in the balcony, chain-smoking and drinking vodka.
I was wondering, it's kind of the thing you said about them being really, really good, when he just did it by himself, because I was like, I don't know what the real story is between the problems between Danny Elfman and his brother Richard Elfman, mm-hmm. but they formed Oingo Boingo together, and then they just had, apparently they had a really rocky relationship, and at one point, I had recommended a song off this one album not so long ago, Danny Elfman just decided, screw him, and he did an album just called Boingo. That was everybody in the band except for his brother. And it was great.
Yeah.
It was one of the best albums I ever did. And again, it was that sort of thing, I think of him just going, well, let's just show everyone how necessary you are to the process, shall
yeah.
we?
That's the John Fogerty approach. Is like, well, why don't we all write a third of the album each then, okay? Nobody will work on anybody else's portion of the album. I'll do one, you guys each do one, and then we'll put it out that way. And then you buy the album and you go, this is only one third good. The other two thirds are crap. What's up with... Oh, I see. Yes.
30-year-old Kim Kardashian and 26-year-old basketball player Chris Humphries tied the knot Saturday night in the exclusive Montecito area near Santa Barbara, California. The ceremony will be televised as a two-part special on E! In October. It's the first marriage for Humphries and the second for Kardashian, who was married to music producer Damon Thomas from 2000 to 2004. People and E! Both report that Kardashian wore an ivory gown designed by Vera Wang as stepfather Bruce Jenner walked her down the aisle in front of 440 guests, including Demi Lovato, Mario Lopez, and Lindsay Lohan. A judge has ordered actress Estella Warren to serve 4 months in a residential rehab facility after she entered a no contest plea in a drunk driving case on Friday. LA City Attorney spokesman Frank Mataljan said Warren also sentenced to serve 5 years of informal probation. The Planet of the Apes actress has been facing 4 misdemeanor charges after her arrest earlier this year for crashing into 3 parked cars and tussling with police. The 32-year-old was previously convicted of drunken driving in 2007. A hearing will be held on October 7th to determine if she must pay any restitution. She starred opposite Mark Wahlberg in Tim Burton's horrible, horrible Planet of the Apes movie, and she's also worked as a fashion model. A large film crew is set up in a popular Portland park over the weekend to shoot scenes for an episode of the upcoming NBC TV series Grimm. The fantasy cop drama inspired by the Grimm fairy tales will first hit the TV screens in October. This weekend's filming location was at McLay Park in southwest Portland. Executive producer Todd Milner said he's determined to shoot all the scenes in Portland. He said, "We couldn't think of a better place that gave us more fairy tale-like locations. And not only is it beautiful, especially now, when we shot the pilot in March, it was a little colder and rainier. But it gave us so many looks that we couldn't possibly recreate in Los Angeles."
Did I tell you that I had an audition for that a few weeks ago?
No, you did not.
Yes. It was, what is the least likely, leaving aside construction worker, what is the least likely manly profession for which I could audition?
For like, that would be like a fairy tale thing?
Well,
because I'm thinking woodsman.
Could conceivably, well, see, it's nothing overtly physical.
Oh, okay.
It's one might call a power profession.
Whew.
And somehow they thought, Emerson, get him in here.
I don't know.
Yes, that would be cop.
Seriously?
Yes,
cop.
They seriously had me audition for the role of a cop.
Oh.
Amazingly enough, I could check my phone now. Maybe they've left me a message. Maybe I've missed this, the callback. Wait, hold on. Oh, no. Apparently they haven't gotten back with me yet. They're playing hard to get, though.
Well, the writers of Grimm have worked on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Angel, and X-Files.
It's David Greenwalt.
Yes. And they list the stars of the show, but they are no one you have ever heard of, so I'm not going to bother to list them.
My hope, though, is that there's lots of story arcs there that need to be resolved quickly through the use of a television newsman. then they're going to be in my wheelhouse, Tom.
Exactly. International news reporter can have kind of a cross-promotional thing.
If it blends with the Leverage verse at some point.
Yes. Kate Winslet and her family were forced to flee their luxury confines this morning after a devastating middle-of-the-night fire broke out at the private home of their holiday host, Richard Branson. Kate, along with her children, Mia and Joe, and her on-again beau, Lewis Dowler, were among 20 people staying at the home, all of whom were forced out as the flames ripped through the abode. excuse me. No one was hurt in the fire. In addition to Winslet's party, Branson's 90-year-old mother, Eve, and his 29-year-old daughter, Holly, a close friend of the royals, were also staying at the so-dubbed Great House on private Necker Island and forced to flee. Branson himself was staying at a different property on the island, 100 yards away. A spokesperson for Virgin Limited confirmed the fire broke out early this morning and caused substantial damage to the home. On his blog this morning, Branson wrote that a tropical storm with winds up to 90 miles per hour had hit the island, with a lightning storm descending on the property around 4 a.m. The fire was said to not be entirely out as of this morning.
We have 90 seconds here.
Well, that's all the entertainment news.
Really?
Yeah.
We're done? It. We're finished?
Yeah, that's it.
Oh, damn it all to hell.
But I do have a short little story I can share at the end of the show.
All right. There's your entertainment news. Don't forget the Rick Emerson Radio program coming up next hour at rickemersonshow.com. Today, Taser Watch, Darwin Watch, also Mr. Aaron Duran with The Week in Geek. That is all coming up next hour at rickemersonshow.com.
And we will end with this. Too many empty beer cans and one full one caused a big problem Sunday morning. After a night of drinking with family members at a home in Lincoln, Nebraska, a relative hit a 43-year-old man with an unopened can of beer at about 1:15 a.m. The man fell to the ground unconscious, and his relative then started kicking him, Lincoln Police Captain Jim David Saver said. The alleged victim later needed 4 staples to close the wound in his head. Police think they know who's responsible, but aren't releasing the person's name.
What was the nature of the dispute?
It really doesn't say. It's like apparently a family drinking all night together. About 1:15, someone got mad at somebody else, heaved a full can of beer at the other guy's head, then he fell down unconscious, and the guy who threw the can at him started kicking him.
Okay. So apparently he hadn't learned his lesson. The thing is, you're giving him what for while he's unconscious when he's not even really going to be aware of it.
No, then you're just venting for your own sake.
Yeah, it seems like that's not really, it's not going to be a rehabilitative
you know.
Or maybe it's frustration because the fight did not continue as planned.
Maybe you weren't able to end the fight with a big flourish because he passed out first, and then you're like, oh, "Dad, come on, you've ruined my ability to have a satisfying resolution to this whole dispute.
I am not getting closure." And then you just get all kicky.
Closure. All right. And with that, we do this, which is bring the curtain down on another exciting episode of Legion of News. Don't forget, you can get this program later on the day via iTunes or as a direct MP3 download here at Cascadia.fm or legionofnews.com. The Rick Emerson Radio Program is next hour at rickemersonshow.com. We come to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the Milk Packing District in glorious Southeast Portland, Oregon. At the news desk, Don Taylor, advanced technology and magic provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, executive producer Bruce Agler, chief of staff Cheryl Kanakoa. As always, we thank you for listening. We will see you next hour at rickemersonshow.com and tomorrow at noon for another exciting episode of Legion of News. Until then, have a safe and satisfying Monday, won't you?